You're listening to an SBS News podcast.
No one in Congress is blocking Epstein documents.
You can't build a brand on conspiracy theories and then get mad when people are interested in your conspiracy theories.
I don't understand what the interest or what the fascination is.
What we are watching on the other side of the world is indefensible.
The Israeli aid system is inhumane and fueling instability.
Welcome to World News Weekly. I'm Katrina Stirrett, and joining me, as always, is Claudia Farhat. Hi, Claudia.
Hello, Kat. Another busy week, it seems.
Indeed.
We have chatted this year on the pod quite a lot about meetings between Russia and Ukraine. We saw another one this week in Istanbul, but once again, it looks like no breakthroughs.
Yep, the meeting lasted for only 40 minutes. As you can imagine, not much can be achieved in that space of time. This was meant to be an attempt to reach a ceasefire. Instead, they did come out agreeing to a prisoner swap. We'll be talking about a conflict of a very different kind as well. We've got the latest on all the MAGA drama coming out of the US, where it seems we have a new bromance breakup every week. This time, Murdoch and Trump turning on each other as Trump fails to fulfil an election promise.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. We're also going to have a story out of Japan this week where we've seen big gains for the far right in an upper house election. That'll be an interesting one. And also some updates out of Gaza where the situation is just continuing to deteriorate. Aid groups are issuing warnings of mass starvation once again, while 28 countries, including Australia, have now signed a joint statement demanding an end to the war.
This is a victory for our planet, for climate justice, and for the power of young people to make a difference. Young Pacific Islanders initiated this call for humanity to the world, and the world must respond.
Some good news for a change, if you're, you know, keen on saving the planet from climate change, that is.
Yeah, good.
A landmark verdict from the International Court of Justice has declared states have a legal obligation to tackle climate change, and that failure to do so is a, quote, wrongful act that could result in reparations.
Yeah, advocates have hailed this as really like a turning point for the future of climate change action, and it could pave the way for the most vulnerable, low-lying nations, many of them in the Pacific, like Vanuatu, to sort of launch litigation action against large polluting states like Australia. And the decision kind of went even further than that, got really specific about fossil fuels as well. It said that these wrongful acts could extend to states not doing enough to lower their greenhouse gas emissions. And that would be, you know, including through things like issuing fossil fuel exploration licenses and providing fossil fuel subsidies as well. That can be considered a wrongful act internationally as well. And Australia, as we know, is a massive subsidizer of fossil fuels. Last year, the latest figures we have, Australia spent $14.5 billion in a year, and that was like a 30% increase on what they'd spent the year before subsidising the fossil fuel industry. But a spokesperson for the Australian government says they welcome this decision from the ICJ and they're now going to carefully consider the court's opinion. I was chatting about it this morning with one of the youngest climate activists that travelled to The Hague during these hearings, a 16-year-old girl from Vanuatu called Vepaya Male Trief. So she went with Vanuatu's national delegation last year. She didn't speak in court, but she did do a lot to raise awareness on the sidelines of The Hague. Here's a bit of our chat from today.
So ecstatic. It was amazing. Very emotional time, moment too, as well, for all my friends and family, because it's has so many implications for our future.
How would you like to see bigger nations like Australia play a bigger role in combating this?
Things like fossil fuel subsidies and things like that, we need a phase out of fossil fuel use. And so I'd really like to see that from Australia and other polluting states, because it's very important that we start to take climate change more seriously and start to act for the better of all of our people.
Really great to speak with Vepaya Mella there, because it was really young people like her that led the charge on this one. It was actually a group of young law students from 8 Pacific Island nations that launched this legal bid 6 years ago. We now have this 500-page long ruling. It is important to note it's not binding and a lot of big polluters are not party to the ICJ, but this ruling does allow for those countries to still be sued over their emissions. So it means court challenges now are probably going to be given far more weight. and we might see them have more success as a result of that. Our colleague Anton Enos has been speaking with Vanuatu's climate change minister, Ralph Reginvanu, about how all of this could play out.
The court made it very clear that you can take action against states for breaches, and that science is now able to attribute responsibility to states. So it is something we're going to look into. We would prefer to see countries realising what their obligations are and coming to the table to discuss how we're going to, for example, repair some of the climate harm that has already been done.
Vanuatu's climate change minister, Ralph Reginvanu, there. And given Australia's massive reliance on the fossil fuel industry, Kat, it's hard to see how this decision is not going to have far-reaching implications right here at home, but I guess only time will tell.
We were able to keep Japan's tariff rate to 15% when it was intended to be raised to 25%. That is the lowest figure to date for a country that has a trade surplus with the United States.
Japan has finally secured a tariff deal with the US, a drop from 25 to 15% on Japanese exports, as well as a $550 billion investment in the US, which the US says Japan will reap the benefits of 90% of profit from. Their Prime Minister Shigeru Ishiba says he will carefully examine the deal, but believes it's in Japan's national interest. It comes at a turbulent time for Ishiba, who suffered a bruising election result on Sunday. He fell three seats short of maintaining control of the upper house, having already lost the lower house last October. This led the Japanese media to report Ishiba will announce his resignation by the end of the month. Ishiba has since denied these claims, saying they are completely unfounded and that he intends to stay on to deal with things like the US negotiations.
Yeah, much like here in Australia back in May, this really turned out to be a cost of living election in Japan. They've had like huge surges in prices of staples like rice. Remember on the pod a couple months ago, we had that story about the minister who had to stand down after making a joke about rice prices. But also wages haven't been rising, and the cost of maintaining welfare payments in this like really rapidly aging society has put quite a bit of burden on the country as well. So now Ishiba's lost control of the upper house, but he also lost control of the lower house last October during another election. So he's now no longer in control of either house, and that's just going to add to all of this political instability in Japan. It's going to make him much more reliant on other parties to get things done. He's been able to get things done with their help in the lower house. We'll see if it's the same in the upper house. And this is kind of like a really historic result. His party, the LDP, has been in power in Japan for all of except five of the last 70 years. Yeah. And for those years that they've run the country, 65 years, they've never lost control of both houses. So obviously, as soon as this happened, he's just facing massive calls to stand down. As you mentioned, he refused to. We have reports that he's considering it, but he's denying that they're true. We'll see. I'm sure it won't be the last we hear of it, though.
Yeah, and, you know, the big winner appears to be the far right, particularly this fringe party called Sancito, which ran a Japanese first anti-immigration campaign, and which interestingly has conspiracy theory origins.
Yeah, that's right. They started only a couple of years ago, really, during the COVID-19 pandemic. And it actually started as a YouTube account. Right. And they sort of gained popularity, as a lot of accounts did at that time, posting conspiracy theories about vaccines mostly. Obviously, in most cases, you know, completely false claims. Mm. But they've since, you know, using that platform, managed to sort of launch into mainstream politics. Before this vote that happened on Sunday, they only had one seat in the upper house. They've now got 15. They added another 14 just in that election.
Yeah.
And their leader says that their politics today, less so where they began in this COVID space, and he now says that he's openly admitting he's inspired by the politics of Donald Trump. He led this anti-globalist immigrant scare campaign. He warned that there's this silent invasion of immigrants coming into Japan. It's worth noting that there's only 3% of foreign-born people in Japan compared to something like one-third of the country here in Australia. So the numbers aren't quite there.
Yeah.
And the irony of it is that the reason Japan has had to sort of ramp up its immigration over the last few years is because of this aging population, right? The birth rate's down, the population is older, there's huge gaps in the workforce, and they are having to bring people in from outside to fill those roles. By the way, the leader of this Sanseito party blames Japan's gender equity policies on that declining right. birth rate, which is kind of interesting. But in any case, the anxiety over this immigrant wave, as he calls it, really did seem to pick up during the latter part of this campaign, and it looks like Sanseito capitalized on it. But it could, you know, really influence how Ishiba's party has to go forward now. I mean, the criticism he was facing from his supporter base before the election was that he wasn't conservative enough, right? So he kind of lost those votes to the far-right parties on the right side of his supporter base anyway. And he did try to, there was a sense like this was coming. He tried to speak to some of these issues in the lead-up to the campaign. He banned tourists from driving, for example, and he pledged to reduce illegal migration to zero. But he has to balance all of that, that seems to be kind of, you know, gaining popularity against the economic and workforce realities of, you know, this very aging population. Regardless, Sanseito now has 15 seats and these are 6-year terms. So they're here to stay and we'll probably be hearing a lot more from them.
Absolutely.
The new Israeli aid system is inhumane, it's dangerous, and it deprives Gazans of human dignity.
We've seen too many images of children being killed, of horrific slaughter.
So it's not the first time we've seen the international community come out to condemn Israel's actions in Gaza, but a joint statement signed by 28 countries, including Australia, as well as an EU representative, is the latest and perhaps the strongest language we've seen so far against Israel. You know, UK Foreign Minister David Lammy made a very impassioned address to Parliament, and we've seen him do this before, but he used language like grotesque imagery is being seen out of Gaza and really condemned actions that we're seeing there of starving civilians, essentially. The statement called for an immediate end to Israel's war on Gaza and condemned the, quote, drip feeding of aid and the, quote, inhumane killing of civilians.
Yeah, it was a strong statement, certainly, and, you know, from I guess somewhat influential nations, yeah. UK, France, Australia. I guess the question, though, is whether it's going to bring about any change, because as we've spoken about on this pod over and over, the rhetoric has been upped at various points before and it hasn't really influenced anything on the ground at all. I mean, in fact, a lot of the time things have only gotten worse. Mm. These killings around aid sites have only increased. And I guess the next question is, well, what action is going to follow the words? In the case of the UK, which was a signatory to this letter, it's still selling arms to Israel, right? Mm. Arms that are most likely being used in this war in Gaza. It did suspend some of its arms licenses, export licenses to Israel, but there's still at least 200 that we know of in place. And it also sells F-35 components to the US, components that the US put in these jets to give to Israel to drop its bombs on the Gaza Strip. Regardless of all of that, many analysts agree until the US sort of joins the pressure and until the US follows up the pressure with action, namely suspending those weapons deliveries, there's not going to be much change at all. Israel's response to this has been that all statements and all claims should be directed at the only party responsible, it says, for the lack of a deal and for the release of hostages and a ceasefire, which is Hamas, which started this war and is prolonging it. Mm. Obviously, prolonging it is what the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has been long accused of in Israel virtually since this war began.
Yeah, and on top of that, more than 100 aid organisations have joined in solidarity to warn of mass starvation in Gaza. On Wednesday, they also called for an immediate ceasefire, the opening of all land crossings, and the free flow of UN-led aid mechanisms, importantly. And we know, of course, there's been consistent criticism of the US-led and Israeli-backed Gaza Humanitarian Foundation's aid distribution. Israel's government spokesperson David Mensah denied these claims, saying there is no famine caused by Israel and rather a man-made shortage engineered by Hamas. And not only are we seeing horrific scenes of civilians collapsing from starvation, but there are also reports of aid workers themselves starving, unable to access food and water. And all this while thousands of boxes of medical supplies, food, hygiene kits are packed in warehouses just waiting and ready to be given the green light.
Yeah, not just aid workers, but now media workers, yeah. Journalists as well. AFP, the French press agency, released a pretty powerful statement this week saying that its journalists, its photojournalists, the people it employs on the ground are now also at risk of dying from starvation. It mentioned a couple of photographers, one who's already lost as much as 30 kilos because of the lack of food. I want to read to you a bit of this statement. It said, since AFP was founded in August of 1944 during the Second World War, we have lost journalists in conflicts, we have had journalists wounded and prisoners in our ranks, but none of us can recall seeing a colleague die of hunger.
Yeah.
That statement was picked up pretty widely around the world, and other media outlets like the AP, BBC and Reuters have now joined them. They've issued another statement calling on Israel to ensure adequate food gets in for all people in Gaza, including media workers. They kind of pointed out in that second statement as well that these independent journalists in Gaza have been the only way people outside, all of us around the rest of the world, have been able to get any information out. So if they were to stop working, that information would kind of stop flowing as well.
Yeah, yeah, that's absolutely right. And I've been speaking with Amra Lee, humanitarian practitioner and researcher on protecting civilians from Australian National University, about all of this earlier today, and here's a bit of what she had to say.
So I think first it's important to situate the gravity of the situation in Gaza right now. So there is a growing body of evidence that's been there for a long time, and expert opinions that this is preventable. It is man-made. I think there's been a perception in the past that famine is an accident or unavoidable. I think in this case, it's very much engineered.
Israel rejects accusations that they're responsible for a man-made famine, as you just described. And then on Wednesday, when the aid organisations came out to really condemn Israel's actions, Israel said it was not responsible for a chronic shortage of food in Gaza, instead again accusing Hamas of deliberately creating a crisis. What's your response to this?
I don't think there's evidence to support those allegations. And I think we also have to be really cognizant of what the issue is right now. It's 2.1 million people being starved, over 1,000 killed, 4,000 injured. People are in desperate situations. Their dignity has been stripped. This has prompted Australia to join 28 countries condemning this behaviour, calling for an immediate end to the war and for a ceasefire to stop this. I don't think these statements are made in good faith. I don't think there's evidence for it. The UN has refuted it and published online their multiple systems for ensuring aid reaches who it needs to get to, including end-to-end tracking. So I just think this is very extremely concerning conduct from Israel at this point in time.
But I don't understand why the Jeffrey Epstein case would be of interest to anybody. It's pretty boring stuff. It's sordid, but it's boring.
Obviously, the Trump administration is trying to cover up. Something changed.
Drama in the magosphere as Trump faces mounting pressure to follow through on a campaign promise to release the Epstein files. Thousands of pages of evidence in the case against convicted pedophile and financier Jeffrey Epstein, who died in prison. This big Epstein reveal was something Trump really campaigned on, a promise to expose political rivals, making insinuations about former President Bill Clinton's affiliation with Epstein. And then suddenly the Justice Department comes out at the beginning of the month to say, case is closed, there's no Epstein client list, and he did die by suicide. So really a nothing to see here kind of sentiment.
Yes, a big nothing to see here, but one that the MAGA base largely isn't buying.
No.
And many of them are furious about this. I mean, this is arguably some of the biggest anger they've shown towards Trump, you know, since he was re-elected. But even in his first term, nothing really compared to this. And it's being led, this is probably why it's gained so much traction, by some of the, you know, biggest pro-Trump, Trump-friendly media figures like Tucker Carlson, right? So they're questioning now why Trump's had this sudden change of heart, you know, going from I'm going to release the files, I'm going to expose all of these powerful people who are in on it, to saying nothing to see here. And the obvious speculation that's being made without evidence, we should say, is that it's because Trump is somehow implicated. The extent his team is going to sort of shut this down, House Speaker Mike Johnson the other day shut down the chamber early just to prevent the Democrats from calling to release these files until September now. The Democrats are calling this a cover-up of epic proportions.
Yeah, yeah. And fast forward to this week, Trump is suing the Wall Street Journal for a whopping $10 billion over its reporting of a rather lewd letter they say he wrote for Epstein's 50th birthday. So the Journal says the letter is a drawing of a naked woman's body with Donald, so his name scrawled below her waist, sort of indicating pubic hair. At the bottom, the words, quote, "May every day be another wonderful secret." Mm-hmm. This was a letter collected by Epstein's sex trafficker conspirator and then partner Ghislaine Maxwell, who, according to the Wall Street Journal, collected a bunch of these to form this sort of birthday album for Epstein in 2003. So based on this, it's not a good look for Trump, obviously.
Yeah, and obviously Trump and his campaign have staunchly denied this. His defence to it is that, well, he says he doesn't draw. His quote was, "I never wrote a picture." Yeah. That's, we know, untrue even by his own admission. I mean, back in a 2008 book he published, he wrote about spending a few minutes sketching drawings to donate to charity to raise money for, you know, communities in need. And he spoke about, you know, drawing, you know, skylines. We've seen some skylines of Manhattan that have sold for tens of thousands of dollars at auction. Well, they're kind of, you know, done in black Sharpie in a style that's not dissimilar to how the Wall Street Journal described this 50th birthday card. This, though, if we step back and look at him, you know, suing the journal, I mean, this is the first time in history that a sitting US president has actually sued the media. And he's not just suing the media, he's suing formerly friendly media. Yeah. The Wall Street Journal, you know, published this despite Trump apparently personally asking Rupert Murdoch, its owner, not to go ahead with it. So the fact that Murdoch did that, I mean, this is just another massive MAGA rebellion, it looks like. And it's not the only case of Trump, you know, going after the media right now. I mean, you'll remember, like, Colbert's Late Show was cancelled. Recently, CBS said that was for financial reasons, but it was the number one rated late show in America. So a lot of people questioning that. Its owner, Paramount, needs government approval to sell the network, right? It's like this $8 billion deal, sell it to Skydance. And the fear is that Colbert was too anti-Trump, so that might have presented some sort of barrier to the government approving that deal, and that CBS may have cancelled the show as some sort of effort to appease Trump. Right. And Trump kind of, you know, these rumors that were circulating about the reason for the show being cancelled, he kind of egged it on. He was really reveling in the show's axing. And when Colbert's peers like Jon Stewart came out in support, he said he'd be happy to see the end of their careers as well.
And just now, Trump's Attorney General Pam Bondi is also facing Democratic calls to testify before Congress following the Wall Street Journal's revelation that she actually told Trump that his name appeared in the files. But to deflect further, Trump is launching this massive distraction campaign, essentially, from the Epstein issue. He came out to accuse former US President Barack Obama of treason, accusing him of colluding with Russia to interfere in the 2016 election. That might sound familiar because, of course, it's not the first time Trump has leveled completely unfounded claims against his political opponents. We all remember various accusations he made in 2016 against his political opponent, Hillary Clinton, including that she and others were responsible for racketeering and so on to undermine his campaign despite, of course, winning in that election.
Yeah, and Obama doesn't usually sort of react, but he has in this case. He said that usually it's his policy not to respond to any sort of vitriol like this from the current administration, but this was so outrageous that he felt he had to speak. He called it out as a weak attempt at distraction. And distraction is largely what Trump's being called out for now in America and even by his own MAGA base, raising all of these new issues like the Obama treason issue to distract from this Epstein case. So, you know, what else have we seen this week? Well, a release of the MLK assassination files. We've seen Trump threaten the Washington Commanders NFL team if they don't change their name back to the Redskins. We've seen Coca-Cola sort of agree to use American cane sugar in its drinks in an effort to appease Trump. These are all MAGA issues, right? You know, not being woke, using American products, things like that. But it doesn't seem to be working. The MAGA bases, the MAGA voices that are leading this, a lot of them in the sort of, you know, MAGA right media space, are not looking away. Something else about this case that's kind of interesting to me is that you've got like three of the most powerful people in the world being Donald Trump, Elon Musk, and Rupert Murdoch, and they're all falling out over this case, right? So you remember, like, we talked about the bromance being over a few weeks ago when Musk dropped all those tweets and he said the bombshell of the day was the reason Trump's not releasing the Epstein files is because he's in them. Mm-hmm. And now Trump's suing Murdoch, right? Like, arguably the person that's done the most to put him in power through his MAGA media network, right? Mm. So what are the implications of this going to be? I mean, he's no stranger to sort of relationship breakdowns and feuds, but this is with two people arguably more powerful than he's ever sort of fallen out with before.
Yeah, this really seems to be the issue that the MAGA base will not let go of. Mm. So time for a quick whip around the globe for some of the other big stories happening this week. So we spoke only weeks ago about a US brokered deal between the Democratic Republic of the Congo and Rwanda. And we did note at the time there was an exclusion of the M23 rebels in the deal, despite the fact they're one of the main players in the conflict in Eastern DRC. But now it appears a deal has been signed between the DRC and M23 rebels in Qatar.
Yeah, they're calling this a declaration of principles. Mm. It's being put forward as a roadmap towards a permanent peace settlement. The terms say that both sides need to refrain from attacks, both sides need to refrain from hate propaganda, as well as any attempt to force new positions on the ground. A couple of things it didn't address, though, was the M23's withdrawal from the towns and areas that it's occupied since that rapid advance we saw them have towards the start of this year, and also the withdrawal of the Rwandan troops that are widely believed to be on the ground in the eastern DRC assisting them. So there are still a lot of questions to be answered.
And it seems Japan isn't the only one signing off on trade deals with the United States. Philippines President Ferdinand Marcos Jr. met with Donald Trump in the Oval Office this week, describing their new trade deal as a significant achievement despite emerging with a tiny 1% reduction in tariffs, bringing the Philippines' levy on exports down to 19% from 20%.
Yeah, Marcos certainly would have been looking for more than that.
Yeah.
Interestingly, in their meetings, Trump sort of oscillated between complimenting and criticising Marcos in the Oval Office meeting, which was all live on TV as usual. He seemed to sort of berate him in front of the press for being too tough in negotiations. Perhaps that's why he didn't get more of a cut on that tariff rate. But he also had plenty to say about how he's from a great family. His father, Ferdinand Marcos Jr.'s father, being senior, was the dictator who ruled the Philippines for 21 years until he fled during a popular uprising. We do know the US president loves a family dynasty, though.
He definitely does. So I've got a little bit of trivia for you. You know how we love trivia on this podcast.
Here we go.
Do you recognise any of these countries?
Okay.
Seborga, Pulvia, Westartica, Londonia.
I definitely know Londonia.
Yeah.
I think this mug was made in Londonia.
Oh, absolutely.
It says on the bottom.
It's known for its, you know, huge export of mugs.
Yeah, obviously. Definitely. Biggest mug market, yeah.
Well, one man in India has been offering services as their ambassador.
Oh.
Before police arrested him, accusing 47-year-old Harshvardhan Jain of running a bogus embassy from a rented residential building near Delhi, recovering cars with fake diplomatic plates. And he allegedly duped people for money by promising them, you know, exciting overseas employment opportunities as well.
Yeah, apparently he was suspected of money laundering through shell companies abroad. He also faces charges of forgery, impersonation and possessing fake documents. Side hustle and a half, I guess.
Yeah, I must say the embassies have the best views in Sydney. Have you seen where they're located?
I have, actually.
The heights of Bellevue Hill.
Yeah, like harbour views
Incredible.
Often.
I don't blame him.
No, you could see why it would be an enticing.
Lucrative as well. Well, on that note, that's The World This Week. But don't forget to like and subscribe if you're enjoying the pod, and feel free to drop us your thoughts on what you'd like to hear a little bit more of at wnwpodcast@sbs.com.au. See you next week, Claudia.
Until then.